My name's Jonathan Furix. Just by way of introduction, I'd say it means something to me that I've worked in almost every level of the church, from local to global, and quite a few different parts of the country, of the world. And I work currently on this issue and some other things at the World Council of Churches in Geneva. So thank you for it. Feels like a long teaching day for those of us who started with a Bible study. Michael here. So thank you for coming at this hour, and I look forward to our time together. The session that you're at is part of a series I called Saving Holden and Everything Else, sort of a soft entry to a difficult topic. Let us be nuclear free. And this particular session, the title is really a question I want to come back to at the end. Nuclear weapons, ultimate weapon, or Guinness Book of Record for crazy? So get ready to declare yourself at the end of the hour on that dichotomy. The session will spend some time on awareness. What is our awareness? It'll spend some time on two perspectives, the human and the scientific. And then it'll give a bit of an overview of the problem, with some of the foretaste of what's to come in other sessions, and coming back to that question I just mentioned, and another one. But I would really like to start with you, because of the nature of this issue, and the nature of the history of this issue, and also just as a way for me to learn from you. And by doing that, by trying to do that, what I'd like to do is give you three questions in 3 minutes, which you will deal with in little groups of three. So look around for three people near you and get ready to form a cabal. And deal with these three questions in 3 minutes, and then we'll take some time at the front of the session to talk about them. The three questions are here. Okay, how many countries have nuclear weapons? B. Why do we, USA, why does the U.S. have them? And C, should we keep them? Your feelings and understandings and preferences about that. So ready? You have three people in mind?
I have 3 minutes for all three questions.
3 minutes for all three. You've got about a minute per question.
And then they want you to spend another
10. Time is right. Don't spend too much time on any one question, especially on the first one.
We think it's less than we have. I think it's
should be on the second question. Should be on the third question. All right, no wrong. Yeah, they're just having a short question. I'm talking about these three questions. Yeah.
I don't know.
Towards the end of their life.
Okay, 20 seconds. Looks like they're finished, huh? All right, don't be shy now. Let's just get a sense of where we are on with some of those basic questions. How many countries have nuclear weapons?
Eight.
Okay.
That we know of.
Okay, eight is one answer. Somebody else?
Well, say seven with Israel as in eight.
Seven?
Israel.
12.
12. Upper teens?
Upper teens.
Okay. Well, depending what you say about North Korea, the answer is nine. So you guys are pretty good. Well, the five permanent members of the Security Council.
Yep.
So U.S., Russia, this is in descending order of arsenals. U.S., Russia, China, France, Great Britain. Then the ones who are outlaws, they're not part of the treaty, they're not recognized, India, Pakistan, Israel.
And nine.
Sorry, I'm wrong. It should be eight. With
I think it's eight.
Eight with North Korea. North Korea has had two putative explosions. They probably have something. Okay, why do we have them? Just shoot out the answers.
Because they have them.
Excellent answer.
Because
excellent.
We developed them first.
And used them.
And we're the only ones to use them.
But why do we have them now? It's 60 years later.
Supposedly as a deterrent.
Okay.
The terrorist.
To keep the terrorists at bay. Good.
Because we can make a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if there aren't just strong interests that keep us creating. Yeah.
All right. Anybody else? A different answer?
It's hard to get rid of them.
It's hard to get rid of them. I think these have all been good answers. You guys are obviously holding it. All right. Should we keep them?
No.
Come on, let's not have false unanimity here.
No, on a limited scale.
Bill doesn't know. On a limited scale. Okay. Any other answers? Should we keep them?
We should get rid of them together. All
get rid of
them together. Nuclear nations should get rid of them together.
Okay.
Is the problem with that, and again, there's always the question, I'm playing hard line, there's always going to be that question these days of, the so-called rogue nation or individuals even. So would it be possible that what we were talking about, maybe if you can't get rid of them entirely, you have some kind of international organization that has a nuclear arsenal that is there to monitor and will, in agreement, to protect nations that voluntarily give them up.
Okay. Anybody else with a little elaboration?
Be the change.
Be the change. Be the change you want to see. Anybody else?
Well, in the Cold War, we had this mad philosophy of mutual assured destruction, and it seems to me that other countries with conflicts, North Korea, South Korea, Iran, Israel, all that, are sort of coming to that same madness.
India, Pakistan.
Thank you very much. I mean, do they keep them? It seems like the same craziness that spurred the Cold War and the nuclear proliferation there, and just between the Soviet Union and the U.S. is that same craziness is taking place elsewhere in
right.
conflicts around the world.
We had the SALT talks 1 and 2 after Matt.
Yeah. Okay. So everybody pretty much on the same page. There's 9 with North Korea.
8.
No, it's actually 9.
Yeah,
with North Korea. We have them because you heard why we have them. Should we keep them? Pretty much everybody said no, but then we started hearing some other thoughts. Okay? What I'd like to do to get us going is give you a little tiny introduction and then start with the first sort of perspective I want to share. Two perspectives, human and scientific. But just to introduce it, this in your mind in relation to the theme, the promises of God here at Holden this summer. One of the things that I always think of in this issue is that humanity is the crown of creation. In a way, we are God's biggest yes, even if we also read that God wants to say yes to us with all of God's promises. We're the crown of creation. Is there anything we've done with all of our brains and all of our image of God that we have, the creativity, the independence, the will, the power, is there anything we've done that is a bigger misuse of our talents than nuclear weapons? And I don't just mean that for their power. I also mean for what they're made of. God made a whole universe out of exactly the same things that we have here on Earth. And in this case, we've taken one of those elements, and we've created a couple other elements to go with it now, and we've taken God's creative force and turned out with a little tiny hint of how powerful God's building blocks are, turned it into something which can destroy. Not creation, mind you, but the part, the little tiny part of creation that God gave to we who think we're so smart. We're at a point where we're able to challenge God's gift to us. If we're his biggest promise, and the place he gave us to live as an expression of his creative love and grace, we're at a point where we can challenge that. And is it the first time in history where we reached that point? I think it is. Yeah.
I would argue that our use of liquid petroleum to generate our transportation probably has an immediate and real effect, as opposed to the possible effect of nuclear weapons.
I was just about to say that this is the first, because we did this before we knew what we were doing with petroleum, but now climate change has some of the same potential. They're both misuses of energy. In nuclear weapons, you misuse energy in a heartbeat and you destroy everything. With petroleum, you misuse it for 200 years or 300 years, and you may destroy a lot.
But what about the history of genocide? I mean, maybe it didn't threaten the whole human species, but it destroys entire groups of this creation.
Yeah.
That are gone forever.
No, I agree. But I'm talking planetary. You know, this is the first thing. The genocides are beyond belief. Let's come back next year to a week on genocide. But this is more than genocide.
I wasn't questioning that, just yeah. The way you framed the question in terms of it being the first thing that can undo the work of God. And it seems
on a planetary scale, okay. Yeah, where we put at risk our little tiny part of the big creation. So, you know. Let's spend a little bit of time looking at a video which I saw this summer on the sides of a UN conference. It was made by a Canadian Japanese woman who was a journalist but had never made a video before, as far as a documentary, as far as I know. And she showed this, and I think she did an excellent job. She has a connection to Hiroshima because her sister was lost in the explosion. And this is what the show she made. Can you, with your hands on the switch there, We'll look at 9. Oh, we better start this first. Can you push the standby button? It's on the left side, I think. On the top. On the very top. It says standby on.
Which button is the left button? I can't read.
With somebody who's taller, maybe come. Oh, but maybe the power in back is on. The little power switch.
Yeah. Press the big button in the middle.
No, you just turn it off. Turn off the toggle switch again. There, it's on. There we go. Okay, this the translation of the Japanese title is No More Hiroshima, No More Nagasaki. To make light at this point? There you go. I just say, going to the treaty bodies that deal with this, what you miss completely, almost completely, the only people who bring it in is civil society, when we have our 3 hours to talk, is the human element of nuclear weapons. Shall we see if it starts? Yeah.
It was a day of the labor service. My younger sister Kaniko wore a beautiful indigo top. My older sister had made it for her the day before. To make it look cute, she put white colors around the neckline and cuffs. My little sister was so pleased and said, "Thank you. Thank you, sister." The next morning, she was so happy to wear those clothes.
The notion that the United States is getting ready to attack Iran is simply ridiculous. Having said that, all options are on the table.
Atom bombed in the city. When she went outside, there was a big noise and flash. She was exposed to the flash and turned black. This is Fumiko. This is Fumiko. I really wanted to hold her and put my cheek against hers, but I couldn't. Her skin was peeling off. "Pull yourselves together." "Yes, Father." "I want water," she said. "Please give me water. Help me." I can't turn off the voices. Do any human beings deserve this?
みんな上げて助けてください、行ってくれよかって水を飲ませてくださいって。 北で光った後にドーンと音がしたと。私知らないですね、音は知りません。光ったのだけしか覚えていません。で立ち会ったんですけれども、周りがちょっとびっくりしてしまって、もガタガタ震えて足がかっこよくなって地面にぴったりと足を一度動けないです、ガタガタ震えて。で、母ちゃん早く助けに来て、妹も来ていませんし、男の子もいませんし、どこ行ったんだろうって思ったら、もうでも動けないので、助けて、助けて、さっき言ったんで。
How's your imagination? Feeling is running pretty high about now, and there's reason for it. If everything goes according to plan, we'll soon see the largest explosion ever set off on the face of the Earth. You'll have a grandstand scene here for one of the most momentous events in the history of science. In less than a minute, you will see the most powerful explosion ever witnessed by human eyes. The blast will come out of the horizon just about there. And this is the significance of the moment. This is the first full-scale test of a hydrogen device. If the reaction goes, we're in the thermonuclear era.
Every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. This family knows what to do, just as your own family should. They know that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn.
Cover in real time in the 50s. It's pretty striking to have that contrast at the end between what we were being told and what they knew was happening. And just to share the fact that although I think some records are still classified, but what the US knew about what the bomb had done to the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 3.5 weeks after the bomb, the first foreigner reached, the first civilian foreigner reached Hiroshima. And it was a Red Cross delegate from the International Red Cross, the Swiss Red Cross, the ICRC. And his name was Fritz Bilfinger. And this is the telegram he sent when he got back to Tokyo, 30th of August, 1945. Visited Hiroshima 30th, conditions appalling, stop. City wiped out, 80% all hospitals destroyed or seriously damaged. Inspected two emergency hospitals, conditions beyond description, full stop. Effective bomb mysteriously serious, stop. Many victims apparently recovering suddenly suffer fatal relapse due to decomposition of white blood cells and other internal injuries. Now dying in great numbers, stop. Estimated still over 100,000 wounded in emergency hospitals located surroundings, sadly lacking bandaging equipment, medicine, stop. Please solemnly appeal to Allied High Command, consider immediate airdrop relief action over center city, stop. Required substantial quantities of bandages, surgical pads, ointments, 3.5 weeks later. For burn sulfamides, also blood plasma and transfusion equipment, stop. Immediate action, highly desirable, also dispatch medical investigating commission, stop. Report follows, confirm receipt, Bilfinger. So I've got copies of that if you'd like to have a copy. And it's very significant again now because with a new director general of the ICRC, and you know their mandate is to use existing law, the laws of war, to moderate the behavior of, and to somehow curb the behavior of armies in war and of governments in war. And they haven't been able to do anything about nuclear weapons because there's no law against them. But using what the International Court of Justice has done in 1996, the ICRC, where they said the threat or use of nuclear weapons is generally illegal under the existing laws of war, even though there is a specific decision about that and it's a non-binding decision, the ICRC has spoken out beyond their mandate on nuclear weapons, recalling what this guy said to them way back then and what their concerns sit up until now. And I think that's a sign of a really important hope in the landscape of diplomacy and how these kind of things go. If you've got questions of clarity about the film, let's clear them up, what you saw, what you didn't see. And then I want to move on from the humane side to the scientific side. Yeah?
Is it uploaded to YouTube?
This film?
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't looked for it. But if it was, it would be no more Hiroshima, no more Nagasaki. The woman's name is Yuki Nakamura. She's a Canadian from Toronto.
And you just saw it for the first time recently?
Yeah, in May.
In May.
She made it in 2007.
Okay.
And it goes on. There's a lot more to show, but mm-hmm. It's an excellent film. Any other questions?
Like, I've been a student fisher, but there's no mention of the firebombing campaign that was being conducted at the same time. Kurt LeMay, the commander of the Pacific Air Force, had completely turned a new chapter, and they were doing the same thing using conventional weapons on a nightly basis all throughout Japan. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a punctuation mark in the events, but I mean, this wasn't just two cities that disappeared essentially. I mean, this was a campaign that was going on nationwide. Tokyo at this point was like 65% burned down, and other cities were up into the 98 percentile of total destruction just under use of conventional weapons, dropping incendiaries, napalm incendiaries. So, I mean, this is just one tool that we used at the time.
Well, let's keep that phrase in mind, okay? Just one tool.
Yes.
All right?
Just one of them.
On the science side, nuclear weapons are quadruple killers. Okay, they kill four ways. And it's worth just spending a little bit of time on that. You've got the blast, you saw the pictures, and you've got the heat. All right? And then you've got the radiation. And then you've got something that people figured out in the 1980s and have recently reconfirmed, and we'll come to it later, but I'll put it down here to have you thinking about it, climate change. And if you look at these factors and you analyze them, you can say that the first two, to speak to your point, are actually, you know, genocide all by themselves. Because in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in Hiroshima, 140,000 people died from the blast and the heat. 140,000 people in essentially a few minutes, however long the heat took to cook the ones that were far enough away to just get burned. Fire spread well beyond the blast zone, actually, from the bomb. From the radiation, you could include that in the genocide because the estimates are that 2 to 3 times as many people died in the longer run because of the radiation and radiation sicknesses from what was caused by the initial blast and heat. When you get to this, the numbers become almost unbelievable. But just to give us a bit of scale, I'd like to indulge in a little bit of math. Let's say X plus Y plus Z equals the numbers, okay? So if you've got 140,000 people killed in the blast and the heat of Hiroshima, with a 15 kiloton bomb, so 15 KT, 15,000 tons of TNT was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The bomb material in it would fit in a gallon milk jug. And it was 15,000 tons of TNT, and it killed 140,000 people. The current arsenal that is in US hands, Russian hands, and the other smaller, much, much smaller powers, 95% of the weapons are in the Russian and the US hands. The current arsenal is 500,000 times that the explosive power of the Hiroshima bomb. So if you take the current arsenal, remember we've come a long way down to where we are now. The current arsenal, you do the math, if one bomb dropped on a city like that can do a relatively a crude bomb, can kill 140,000, let's drop the other bombs on cities. There aren't enough cities in the world to use them on. But if you drop them in the same fashion, the figure you get, I just did the math this afternoon, the 140,000 goes to 70 billion. So in the arsenals of the nuclear powers today, you have enough explosive power, if you could find enough cities to drop them on, to kill 70 billion people. And that's just from the blast and the heat. It's not from the radiation, and it's not from climate change. To give you something to feel happy about, at the depths or the heights of the Cold War, we had 1.4 million times the explosive power of Hiroshima in the arsenals of the US and Russia. The rest, again, nothing compared to us. They have 300 bombs, 200 bombs, the French and the British. If you do 1.4 million times Hiroshima, you get 306 billion people that you can fry if you had the cities to drop them on. Now, people tell me, and I think it's true, that numbers don't work when you're talking about death, okay? One death is a tragedy. It doesn't make sense to say, well, 1,000 deaths is 1,000 times more tragedy. I mean, part of me wants to say that. We have to say something to deal with these kind of figures, because on the third of these sessions, I'm going to talk about how our money paid for this and what it cost us, actually, to be able to have this kind of power. But let's just stick with the force of the explosion right now. This is the X. The Y, I'm not even doing it because with the 70 billion dead from the blast and the heat, you don't need radiation to kill the rest of them. If it's two or three times more. And the Z is the climate. And just listen to the climate statistics. The people who figured out this climate change called it nuclear winter. Remember that in the 1970s? Suddenly we heard about nuclear winter. If you had a nuclear war, the world would go dark and cold for a long time. And they did it without computers, basically. And they came up with this rather dire prediction. Two of the three researchers redid the whole thing, and using the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, the UN's computers for the panel of scientists, they did that with those computers, and they figured out that back in the 1970s they had it right, but they didn't have it half right in terms of how bad it would be. So the statistics that they give, and I have some handouts about this if you want to grab a copy later, but the statistics they give are that if you had 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs and you had a war, and the perfect place to speak about it, somebody mentioned South Asia, would be India-Pakistan. There you have a kind of a classic arms race, two nuclear armed powers, no love lost between them, some strange people in charge here and there, and plenty of reason to get mad at each other. If those folks used 100 nuclear weapons on each other and cities were the targets, the estimate is that, and I think it's quite a very conservative estimate, 20 million people would die in the blasts. 20 million people. But because cities are the targets, and because those bombs you saw turn a city into soot, you know, the black stuff on your exhaust pipe, basically, carbon, soot, turns the city into soot, the buildings, the highways, the steel, turns it into soot, and shoves it up into the upper atmosphere. And so from a regional nuclear war, these guys calculate, 100 warheads being exchanged between India and Pakistan, you would have the world covered in soot within 6 days, and global temperatures would drop by 3 degrees Celsius, and they would stay down for 10 years. The main effect of that would be, you could say, good, we'd stop global warming. Well, again, speaking humanly, it would take 15 days off of the growing season for 10 years. So any place that was on a marginal agricultural basis would lose their marginality even more. And the best way to understand what might happen is 800 million people who are already food insecure, the 800 million hungriest people in the world, what would happen to them? So you can start thinking of casualties in this category. If this is two or three times as much as this, what is this? And if these guys calculated, if we use just the existing weapons that are on high alert status between Russia and the US, goodbye, basically, to life on Earth. Even with the levels that we have today. And the calculation of that, I think, is puzzling, because you don't ever hear it in a policy environment. You hear it in a rare meeting like this, where people put themselves through the pain of trying to understand why we have a problem like this. I'll leave these papers on here if you want to look at them, and you can have a bit of a sense of what we're talking about. If you want to look at the effect of the soot, there's a website called nucleardarkness.org. Okay? And you can go there and you can dial in a 5-megaton weapon on your least favorite city and hit the button, and it'll show you where that soot will go. When I first heard this, I said to the guy, this is put out by a physician's doctors, sort of doctors against nuclear weapons. And I said to the guy, why didn't this happen with all the 300 tests that we had in the 50s and 60s and 70s before tests went under? Why didn't this happen? They weren't all at once, but we had 300 or 400 atmospheric tests. And the answer was quick. Those were exploded over the ocean or over the desert. There was nothing to carbonize. But if cities are targets, you turn the city into soot and you pump it up into the atmosphere in teragrams, you measure that, these trillions of grams of soot, and you get this effect of global cooling and nuclear winter, which is, you know, an amazing fourth dimension on this quadruple killer of nuclear weapons and how they work. One other way to put this in perspective is to tell you about these little circles I have here. And if this is all too much for some of you, maybe this is male to talk this way, but that little dot is meant to signify, it's on this paper that you can get a copy of, that little dot there is all of the explosive power used in World War II. All the firebombing you're talking about there, and the two nuclear explosions. And it's a little tiny dot about the size of a half an aspirin. This is the total explosive power of the US and Russian weapons that are currently on high alert status. That means launch on warning. By the way, the 3 minutes you had to answer these questions, that's about how much time Obama would have to decide whether or not to reply to an attack that was coming, especially if it was coming from Russian submarines. You'd have less than 3 minutes, actually, to decide, do I end the world or do I just let us go down? If you're frustrated by that little exercise, think about what the US president has been dealing with and the Russian president for the last 60 years. But 350 World War IIs, 350 World War IIs are on high alert status still, 20 years after the Cold War has ended. And you got to ask, who are we afraid of? Who is the enemy? Who are they targeted at? But they're on high alert status, same status they were on during the Cold War. This big circle is the total combined explosive power of the US and Russian operable nuclear weapons, the ones we still have, that aren't including these, but more. So, and that's 850 World War IIs. So this is World War II, this is 350 times, this is 850 times. There's another circle. It's about that big, and it's 24, let me get, make sure I have it right here, 24,000 times World War II. And that's the height of the Cold War, when we had about 70,000 nuclear weapons in this planet.
So, let me get ahead of you.
No, go ahead.
But, so, the absurdity of those numbers begs you to ask the question, is why we have to create so many nuclear weapons in the first place. What was the incentive that somebody was saying we make money or something? I mean, where did that come into the? I mean, why do we need to create so many thousands of nuclear weapons? It's obvious. The deterrent factor is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
After you've made it just a few, maybe a dozen. So how did that happen?
Can I answer that, John?
Yeah, please.
A lot of people assume that nuclear weapons are targeted individually by city. What a lot of people don't know is that multiple warheads are targeted for each location. So just taking like Washington, D.C. as an example, the reason they made so many warheads was they would target the White House, they put another warhead on the Pentagon, they put another warhead on the Capitol building, they put another warhead on the National Mall, they put another warhead on Andrews Air Force Base, they put another warhead multiple locations within one city limit, and that's just Washington, D.C. Now you multiply that by Philadelphia, by New York City, by Chicago, by Omaha, Nebraska, by Dallas, by...
Well, I've been to D.C. The White House isn't that far from the Capitol.
Exactly. That's my point. And then the same thing was that the U.S. prioritized their targets the same way. They had one for the Kremlin. They had one for the president's residence. They had one for the Politburo building. They had one for the Ministry of the Interior, where the KGB was.
Why, the question is why, still?
Because
why would they have so many in one little area if you could build the whole thing up with one?
Well, those
places
have
hardened bunkers that were designed to withstand impacts and direct hits.
Well, when they do the thing on, it's called the atomic audit, I think it's going to be on Thursday. There's a great example of this, and it's what they're saying, but it's actually including also the fact that there are dozens of warheads targeted on the same thing, because they just simply did not have enough targets. Dozens. I'm sitting at dinner with a guy who used to be a silo man, and now he's in the Pentagon as a lawyer for the Air Force. And he said, yeah, it was a bit hard for us to get excited about the latest target list we got, what we're supposed to put our missile on now. He was out in Wyoming. Because they knew, you know, he said, was it exciting to be told you're the 29th missile targeted on this radar station on the outskirts of Moscow? And I was shocked to hear him say that, because he's a serving colonel in the Air Force. But that was his, you know, moment of honesty about what was happening. Back when he was a silo man, missile man.
And the silos too, that they determined them such hardened targets that were just mentioned up here, that the only way that those silos in and of themselves could be damaged to hopefully prevent the launch was to hit by direct hit. It's like each of your aircraft carriers can only, you know, actually your nuclear powered enemy's class carriers can, they believe, can only be sunk by a direct hit. So, you know, all these capital ships, I mean, everything was multiple target and they were always tracked. And, you know, and the crazy thing about it is this is common knowledge within the military. You know, veterans know this stuff, and, you know, we always wondered about why they always did this stuff. Well, whether you like it or not, the only thing governments really are trying to preserve is what we call the national command authority, i.e. the president and his direct chain of command. The only thing they want to do is, the only priority they have in a nuclear exchange is maintaining the government.
Well, it would seem strange that the nuclear powers, namely Russia and the United States, are targeting each other, and countries in South America are free. I mean, they're going to get the atmospheric effect, but they're not targeted. They're not important. It's an irony.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, and that's a myth too. All nations are targeted. Everybody's signed into treaties. Everybody's mutually assured in their economic stability.
Well, is Valparaiso targeted?
Yeah,
it is.
In all real, they probably have a warhead.
I'm not talking about Valparaiso in the United States.
No,
I'm talking about Chile.
Yeah, South America, Chile. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. But yeah, I mean it's not just Russia and the Soviet and the United States who are targeting each other. It's all of our allies. It's taking out the Chinese too. It's taking out the Koreans, the Japanese. It's not just the United States and the Soviet Union. These targets are allocated worldwide. There's probably even one targeted for Adamson Station in Antarctica, because there would be an American representative still alive there, if not.
Well, Mark, can melt the Arctic ice cap.
Yeah.
And Antarctica ice cap. Flood the world.
Are there other comments or questions? Yeah.
Reducing from the 2,400 down to the 850, we don't really know how to get rid of that stuff anyway. We don't really have a good solution for what to do with it and to make it really safe, you know, afterwards.
The reduced ones, or
yeah, the ones even though we've reduced them theoretically, we don't really know how to make them safe, you know, exactly how to get rid of them in a safe manner.
There's a lot to be said about that. There's huge amounts of fissile material in the world, and the U.S. and Russian stocks are by far the biggest. A little bit of good news for you. Under the influence of Sam Nunn, and I think Richard Lugar, the only Republican who said he would vote for the New START right now, by the way. I don't know, are your Washington senators in line on the New START treaty? Are they both Democrats? Okay. Anybody from Oregon or something? If you've got a Republican senator, please leave this place and tell them to sign this very modest treaty that they signed. It's modest as all get up, but it has verification in it. It's a good start getting back on the road after the last disastrous decade we've had. But you've got to talk to your senators, if you're from, if you're a Republican senator, because none of them have declared. But Nunn and Lugar started a program, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which at the present time, every 10th American home is powered by electricity, which is made with former bomb fuel in Russian warheads. So warheads pointed at us have now been taken apart, blended down into low-enriched uranium, and turned into nuclear reactor fuel. So that's a little example. The work is enormous. There's a huge piles of the fissile material. But you can actually do something about it, making it low uranium. The long-term life, the 250,000 years of radioactivity, which is involved. No, that's not. There's no solution for that we know of. But you can make it way less dangerous than it is now. So that's a bit of a success story. But my question is, this is clearly some form of insanity. I mean, the history will look back on what happened in the Cold War. They'll look back on this and they'll think, if there's a world left, and they'll say, what on earth? What are people doing? And why do we have to live with the radioactive waste of this completely insane behavior? But what fraction of insanity is no longer insanity? it's like calculus. You keep dividing that angle at a small, you still got an angle. Where does sanity break out? Just like you to think about that, because honestly, our country is the main player. Mm-hmm. We have the lead. The Russians hang on to their nuclear weapons as their last ticket to greatness. They got almost nothing else besides their dignity, their numbers, their natural resources, and their incredible national spirit and strength of character for surviving what they've been through. But the imbalance between us is huge, and the nuclear weapons they have are the last thing that they make them a superpower. France has a bit of the same problem. Britain is trying to be virtuous. It's down to one weapon system and one weapon. And we're supposed to say that's great. China, who knows? But the lead is in the American hands. And we've all lived through this. We have a president who says he wants it to change. I'd like to end every one of these sessions by encouraging you to let your views be known to your senators and your representatives, because with the division in Washington right now, this issue can go nowhere. You think Obama's going to lose his office or not get reelected over this issue? Uh-uh. No way. But do we have a heart for the planet? Is this the world God so loves? Are we Christians first or Americans first? Other comments?
Jonathan, do we still have nuclear weapons on submarines?
Absolutely.
Moving around?
Yeah. Now, somebody has a pastor here who
can't be targeted, of course.
Gets themselves arrested in Bangor every few months. Who is that? They're here. Yeah, they reckon Bangor, the sub base in Washington, is the highest concentration of these things in the world.
Yeah.
In Maine, of course.
No, Bangor, Washington.
Bangor, Washington.
Near Bremerton, the sub base.
Okay.
The sub base. Yeah.
Do we know that the Russians also have them on submarines?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if that's where the president gets like 90 seconds to decide, because if a Russian submarine is just enough out to sea that it hasn't been somehow stopped by the 200-mile limit or whatever they do to keep them a little bit out to sea, that missile could come to Washington in what?
Seconds.
6 minutes? Yeah. I mean, you would just have no time at all to do anything. One of my favorite moments was about 3 years ago, Dennis Healey, remember him, the Labour Prime Minister of Britain? He had the guy following him with the football, the briefcase that had the codes and the red button.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, I decided that if the Russian missiles ever came and we got the alert, I decided I wasn't going to fire back. So that man made peace of mind with himself. He said, why kill? We're gonna lose 20 million. Why kill 20 million Russians? Little moment of humanity. Maybe that's actually what saved us, that sort of thing. That God has saved us from ourselves. for the last 60 years. We have done something we should never have done. It makes the Garden of Eden look like kindergarten for disobeying God. But we're still here. Is that a reason for complacency, or is that a reason that the clock is ticking and we want to give this to our children? There's two futures. One future with this stuff, one future without it. That's why I think the Hibakusha are absolutely critical, because the ones you see now were 15, 16. The ones who are now 75, 80. There's still quite a few left, but they're going down quickly now. They're all old. And their witness is the last living witness. Because remember, these things have not been used in war since Nagasaki. They've been used many other ways. I have a book which outlines 44 times the U.S. has threatened to use its nuclear weapons. You saw some of them in the ticker tape stuff there. But yeah, there was a question.
Oh, just a comment there. I had a good fortune to visit Hiroshima once, and there's a bong you can bring there.
Yeah.
And one of the folks that had survived came up to me after I rang the gong and asked me who I was and where I was from, thanked me for being there, and gave me a crane.
Yeah. That lady you saw there, Sakue, the woman, the older woman speaking, she says later in the film, because she tried, she really considered committing suicide. Why should I live in the rubble? And then she said, I realized at the moment she didn't, she could have fallen in front of a train that was coming her way. She said, I decided there would be nobody to bring flowers to the grave. And then later she says, I lived, I'm glad I lived because I can tell you about it. There's so many people like that in Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
I was just going to ask for the names of the people who benefit. Who are the defense contractors that are turning these over and getting the contracts? Who are the biggest ones?
It's under, you know, there's a huge plant in Kansas City, Los Alamos, Sandia National Laboratory, the whole thing in Tennessee where the original one was made. They're full of contractors, but I can't name. I don't know. Does anybody know them?
Raytheon, Grumman.
The normal weapons contractors, I suspect. I mean,
Boeing.
Boeing.
Jordan Viacom.
But the everything is under sort of U.S. government control. You have this huge Nuclear Safety Administration and Energy Department and all that stuff. And Obama's actually putting $30 billion into the complex because we're going to have less numbers of bombs, a little bit less now. Some of these are going to be taken out of dismantled. So we need a better factory somehow. So maybe if we need to repair them more, we can do it better. And it's the only way he can, I think, take this action by mollifying the Republicans. By giving more to the complex, the whole set of those plants around the country. Yeah.
So, Jonathan, what comes to my mind is the word insidious, and if we just think of like who's making the nuclear materials, we may want to name a few, but when we think of all the delivery vehicles, the submarines, the planes, all the supporting staff, it gets very huge, I think, and comes to where it even touches each of us when we have a family member who's making a salary and getting paid, and I even know as a young man and being married and having a family, saying, well, you can't quit, you know, you have to have a roof over your house, a roof to live under and food to eat. Mm-hmm. So how we are all involved in this issue and how we have become complicit in allowing this to happen and supporting it in one way or another, that's where it really brings it home to me.
Yeah, well, taxes is the obvious thing. There are, I'll try to wrap it up here, but there's good political reasons to talk about it. It'll come up in the rest of the week. Excellent economic reasons. This element is absolutely huge in our budget. $5.5 trillion on nuclear weapons since 4696. $5.5 trillion. And Uncle Sam had no idea how much he had spent, because you had the Army racing, the Navy racing, the Air Force, and them all racing the Russian. But that's Thursday. Environmentally, it's really interesting. to think of it at this time in the context of, in the context of climate change. I just want to read a paragraph about spiritual and psychological. Surely we have to reckon with those directly as religious people. Nuclear weapons demand of us the opposite of what God intended for the human community. Nuclear weapons owners control others through fear, hate, resentment, and grudging acquiescence. The owners of the nuclear weapons reap what they sow. They are consigned to the same prison of fear and intimidation they impose on others. I think the best answer for this circle is accepted politics of fear. Just completely irrational sense of fear. And backed up with a lot of examples. They are consigned to the same prison of fear and intimidation they impose on others. Nuclear strategy during the Cold War relied on a balance of terror. Remember that? Such a dirty word now, but it was our main, it was our main strategy, balance of terror. The concept still lives, unfortunately, in the posture and behavior of nuclear powers today, all of them. Hundreds and hundreds of warheads are still on Cold War high alert status, and the so-called war on terror goes on and on as well. Under its logic, nuclear doctrines have been rewritten in the attempt to justify new uses for an unusable weapon. And the first people to say that nuclear weapons are unusable are generals. The first people to say it. They have to shut their mouths sometimes because the politicians don't know what to do with that, so they say, you know, please. Under its logic, international responsibilities and obligations that are the building blocks of shared security are ignored for the inherently destabilizing goals of national security. Can we make it clear? Shared security cannot coexist with nuclear-armed nationhood. You know, we have a world where we're going to be depending on each other for the air we breathe, the physics we live by, the chemistry we live by, more and more. Borders are going to become less and less meaningful for what ails us. And we are going to try to do that with some countries having these things and most of the countries not? I don't think so. They are 20th century nation state anachronisms that have no place in the century we're looking at now. When it comes to nuclear weapons, advancing our shared security must only mean one thing for people of faith: the complete and permanent elimination of these weapons. There's no other position we can take if we are to keep faith with our neighbors and keep faith with God. Now, if it was too grim for anybody, I brought the hymn books in here. And I have a great hymn we could finish by singing. Is anybody interested to try to sing?
I like singing.
I'd really like to do this. Hymn 887, and it's in the nation section of the hymn book. You know what I'm talking about? This is my song. How many people know that song?
Finlandia, the melody.
Finlandia too.
This is my song.
Yeah. Because if there is a God, this is not depressing. Or at least it's not debilitating. It's depressing, but it's not debilitating. God cannot have wanted us to be beaten by this, as far as I can tell. So 887.
We play it on the
calendar. That'd be nice. Boy, we've got everybody here. Sorry, you guys. You can clap, okay? clap for hope and belief that we will get out of this trench. So 887, national songs.
This is my home, come to prepare.
feet of Holden. I think the line to take to bed with you is, other lands have sunlight too and clover, and skies are everywhere as blue as mine. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.